This is Lecture 2 of Essentials of Capitalism. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today, I will attempt to establish the dependency of the division of labor on all the economic institutions of capitalism. Private property, saving and capital accumulation, exchange and money, economic competition and economic inequality, and the profit motive and the price system. I will begin with the dependence on private property, following a few words about the origin of that institution. Private property is the most fundamental of the institutions of capitalism, after freedom and rational self-interest. As I explained yesterday, while vital to the further existence of freedom, it itself is the product of individuals possessing freedom and desiring to improve their material well-being. Such individuals simply appropriate land and raw materials from nature and thereby convert them into private property. Private property in products then follows on the basis of private property in land and natural resources. The owners of land and natural resources own the products that result from them, which, of course, they can exchange with others for services. These others then also own products and can, of course, buy land and natural resources from their original owners. The history of the United States and the colonial settlements that preceded it offers the clearest examples of this process of establishing private property. By and large, the settlers simply moved into what was virtually an empty continent and made major portions of it into private property by direct appropriation from nature. Often, to be sure, the government claimed prior ownership of the land, and the settlers had to pay a fee for what otherwise would have been theirs merely for the taking. And sometimes injustices may have been done to Indians, but this did not affect the essential nature of the process. The private property that exists today in the United States can generally be traced back through intervening purchases and sales to these original appropriations from nature. In most of the world, unfortunately, the history of private property is not so simple. Again and again, owners were forcibly dispossessed by foreign invaders, by the expropriations of governments, and by civil wars and revolutions. In Europe, for example, there is probably not a single acre of land whose history does not record one or more acts of violent appropriation from previous owners. Nevertheless, one of the things I will show in a later lecture is that even where holdings of private property can be traced back to acts of force, the operations of a capitalist society steadily wash away these stains, so that once a few generations have gone by, during which private property no longer passes by force, but by purchase, the result is virtually the same as if it had never passed by force. It follows, incidentally, that there is no legitimate basis for attempting to expropriate the existing owners of private property in the name of rectifying injustices done to owners generations in the past. Indeed, it will be made clear why such attempts must be highly destructive and unjust. Now, the institution of private property underlies the division of labor society in a direct way and in a variety of indirect ways. The direct connection is that the gains from the division of labor fundamentally derive from the fact that individuals possess separate, independent minds which permit them to have separate, independent knowledge and to make separate, independent judgments and decisions. In a division of labor society, each person benefits from the fact that other people possess knowledge which he does not, and an intelligence separate from and often greater than his own. His benefit requires that others be able to acquire and apply their knowledge on their own initiative without having to await his orders, approval, or permission, which in the nature of the case he would be impotent to give in any rational way, since he necessarily lacks the knowledge that would be required to do so. In order for people to act and produce, they must possess the material means of action and production. They must possess wealth. In order for them to act and produce separately and independently from one another, they must hold wealth separately and independently from one another. That is, there must be private property, including private ownership of the means of production. In essence, private property is fundamental and essential to a division of labor society because individualism, that is, the separate thinking and acting of individuals, is fundamental and essential to it, and because it is the material requirement of individualism. By the same token, socialism and collectivism are incompatible with the existence of a division of labor society. This incompatibility would be blatant if the Western world did not continuously rescue the Soviet Union and its allies from famine. A series of famines would lead to a flight from the cities and resettlement of practically the whole of the surviving population of those countries on farms, in an effort of people to secure a food supply. That would mean the end of all significant division of labor in those countries. Consider, collectivism openly demands that everyone think and act as a unit. It leaves no room for the vast differentiation and individuation of knowledge on which a division of labor society rests. The propaganda of socialism fully displays this absurdity when it pretends that under socialism, all economic decisions will be arrived at democratically. In order for people intelligently to vote on all economic decisions, everyone would have to have all the necessary knowledge pertaining to all economic decisions, which is clearly impossible in a division of labor society. Socialism is not rescued from its incompatibility with a division of labor society by substituting the dictatorship of an alleged expert or body of experts for the democracy of the ignorant masses. For now, instead of demanding that everyone know everything about production, it demands that one person or several people, the supreme dictator or the members of the Central Planning Board, know everything about production. The very expression central planning describes the essence of this absurdity. It means that one consciousness must be able to see and plan the entire economic system, either alone or in consultation with one or more other such all-seeing consciousnesses. For central planning means the planning of the entire economic system as an indivisible whole. Socialism is incompatible with a division of labor society because in all of its versions it is incompatible with a division of the intellectual labor required in the planning of the conduct of the economic system. When it attempts such an intellectual division of labor, as it necessarily must, the result is contradictory partial planning. This is a state of affairs in which separate ministries, industries, regions, or even individual factories and farms plan in discoordination and at cross purposes. In a word, it is economic chaos. For details, see my book, The Government Against the Economy. Interjection. The Government Against the Economy has been incorporated in Capitalism as chapters 6 through 8. As a result of this chaos, the whole division of labor disintegrates. The division of labor in the planning process is possible only under capitalism. Here, the price system comes into play. Under capitalism, each individual plans his own particular sphere of economic activity. But he plans on the basis of a consideration of prices, the prices he will receive as a seller and must pay as a buyer. The consideration of prices is what integrates and harmonizes the plans of each individual with the plans of all other individuals and produces a fully and rationally planned economic system under capitalism. For example, a student changes his career plan from actor to accountant when he contemplates the vast difference in income he can expect to earn. A prospective homebuyer changes his plan of which neighborhood to live in when he compares house prices in the different neighborhoods. And businesses change their plans concerning product lines, methods and locations of production, and every other aspect of their activities in response to profit and loss calculations. All these changes represent the adjustment of the plans of particular individuals and businesses to the plans of others in the economic system. For it is the plans of others to purchase accounting services rather than acting services that cause the higher income of accountants. It is the plans of others willing and able to pay more to live in certain neighborhoods and less to live in certain others that determine the relative house prices confronting our home buyer. It is the plans of its prospective customers, of all competing sellers of its goods, and of all other buyers of the factors of production it uses that enter into the formation of the prices determining the revenues and costs of any business firm. Now, the fact that capitalism even has economic planning, let alone the only possible kind of rational economic planning, is almost completely unknown. As I explained in The Government Against the Economy, practically everyone under capitalism has been in the position of Molière's Monsieur Jourdain, who spoke prose all his life without ever knowing it. We haven't realized that all the thinking and planning about our economic activities that we do in our capacity as individuals actually is economic planning. By the same token, the term planning has been reserved for the feeble efforts of a comparative handful of government officials who, having prohibited the planning of everyone else, presume to substitute their knowledge and intelligence for the knowledge and intelligence of tens of millions and to call that planning. We should let this point sink in for a moment. It's rather enormous. Now, the dependence of the division of labor on the price system is an example of its indirect dependence on the institution of private property. I pointed out yesterday that the price system rests on the profit motive and the freedom of competition. Operating in conjunction with one another, these are the elements that underlie and drive the price system, that determine the formation of all individual prices and their integration into a system. Each of these, in turn, rests on the institution of private property. Private property underlies the incentives of profit and loss, in that it is private property that is the substance of what is gained or lost by producers. Private property underlies economic competition, in that economic competition presupposes separate, independent producers, who must hold the wealth they use in production separately and independently from one another. The price system also depends on the institutions of exchange and money. Prices are sums of money exchanged for units of goods or services. The very phenomenon of exchange presupposes the private ownership of the things exchanged. Exchange is a mutual transfer of private property between two parties, with the property of each being given as the condition of receiving the property of the other. The price system further depends on the institutions of saving and capital accumulation, in that the prices of the means of production are not paid by the consumers, who purchase only the ultimate final products, but by businessmen. All the materials and supplies, all the tools and equipment and labor services used in production are purchased and paid for by businessmen out of accumulated capital, not by the ultimate consumers out of consumption spending. The prices of all the means of production, therefore, depend on saving and capital accumulation. And as I indicated yesterday, saving and capital accumulation vitally depend on the institution of private property and on its security. In order for people to save and accumulate capital, to improve the property at their disposal in any way, or even just to maintain it, they must have the expectation of benefiting from such action. They can rationally have that expectation only if that wealth is securely theirs. Thus, through each of these four routes, the price system is grounded in the institution of private property. I would now like to explain some further connections, or further aspects of the connections I have already established between all these institutions of capitalism and the existence of a division of labor society. In the absence of any saving and capital accumulation whatever, everyone's labor would have to be devoted almost exclusively to securing his next meal. With saving and capital accumulation, even if only in the form of stores of food, people can turn their attention to the production of other things. For example, primitive hunters or fishermen who have accumulated stocks of food can live off them while they set about building huts and also better means of hunting and fishing, such as bows and arrows and traps, or boats and nets. The ability to carry on the production of things other than immediate food supplies is an obvious precondition to the development of the division of labor, in that without it, there would be the production of essentially just one thing in which everyone would be engaged. Probably there would be some division of labor even at that level. For example, some members of a tribe might concentrate on chasing animals while others concentrated on the actual killing of them. But a precondition of people specializing in the production of distinctly different products is the ability to carry on the production of such products. And here, saving and capital accumulation are necessary in the case of every product whose production entails the lapse of more time than transpires between two meals. The accumulation of capital is vital in enabling the labor of food producers to become sufficiently productive so that not everyone's labor is required in the production of food. It is only in degree that fewer people are required to produce the food needed by all that more people can devote their labor to things other than food, and thus the division of labor develop. The relationship between the productivity of labor in agriculture and the division of labor is reciprocal. In degree that the productivity of labor in agriculture rises, more people can be spared for industry and the rest of the economic system. At the same time, the effect of a greater division of labor is, of course, a higher productivity of labor in agriculture, as farmers come to work with the aid of more and more products of industry and become more specialized and proficient themselves. Saving and capital accumulation, of course, are no less vital in the context of a monetary economy, as I have already shown. Closely connected with what I have shown about the source of demand for means of production, the existence of savings and capital in terms of money is what enables producers to be paid within a reasonable period of time after the completion of their work. In the absence of savings and capital in terms of money, any significant division of labor would be impossible, because it would then be necessary for many producers to wait years, decades, generations, or even centuries before being paid. This is no exaggeration. Consider, for example, the case of the automobile workers today. At present, like most other workers, they are paid after the completion of a week's work. Yet far more than a week goes by between the performance of the auto workers' labor and the time the auto companies are paid for the cars those workers help to produce. What makes possible the payment of the auto workers' wages after just a week, despite the fact that the auto companies are probably not paid for several months, is the fact that the auto companies possess capital. They pay the wages of their workers week after week out of capital, and only months later do they recover the outlays of any given week in sales revenues. Indeed, even most of the sales revenues of the auto companies are paid out of savings and capital. Most new car buyers buy on installment credit. Under this arrangement, a bank or some other financial institution advances them the funds to buy their car, and they then pay off over a period of 2 to 4 years. In the absence of this capital, and the capitals of the auto companies, auto workers would have to wait in excess of 2 to 4 years before being paid for their work. And the same would be true of all the suppliers of the auto companies, such as the steel and tire companies and the like. They would all have to wait to receive the installment payments from the car buyers. In the absence of capital in the hands of steel and tire producers, as well as auto producers and auto buyers, the period for which companies and workers would have to wait to be paid would be increased still further. The workers employed by the steel and tire companies and the suppliers of the steel and tire companies, such as iron mining concerns and rubber plantations, would all have to wait the full period of time waited by the auto workers, plus the period of time that presently elapses between the payments by the steel and tire companies and the receipt of sales revenues by those companies. The consequence of a further lack of capital by the iron mining concerns and rubber plantations would, of course, be to make the plight of the employees of these concerns and the suppliers of these concerns even worse. And so it would be with every further stage of remove from the direct production of automobiles. The full magnitude of the time factor in production becomes clear if we begin to look at the equipment and buildings used by an industry. For example, the auto industry's equipment probably lasts on the order of a generation, its factory buildings on the order of 2 or 3 generations. If the auto industry did not possess capital funds to pay for that equipment and those buildings, the suppliers of the equipment and the construction contractors involved would have to wait to be paid out of the sales revenues earned by the auto companies over a period of from 1 to 3 generations. In the absence of capital in the hands of the equipment makers and the construction contractors, it would be their employees and suppliers who would have to wait this period of time to be paid, plus the extra time that transpires in the making of the equipment and the construction of the buildings. Already, We are looking at periods of waiting time extending beyond the lifespans of many of the people involved. And when we consider such facts as that equipment and construction materials are themselves made with equipment and in factory buildings, we begin to perceive periods of time in the productive process exceeding a century. For example, the steel girders used to erect an auto plant that will last 50 years may come from a steel mill that is itself now 50 years old, and which was constructed with materials from a previous plant, which at that time was 50 years old. In the absence of capital in the hands of business enterprises, there would simply be no way for extensive time-consuming processes of production to exist. Even substantial savings in the hands of workers would not be sufficient. We might imagine occasional workers with enough savings to enable them to work for a few years before they were paid. But we certainly cannot imagine an economic system in which workers are willing to work and not be paid in their lifetimes, in which payment would not occur even in the lifetimes of their children or grandchildren. In order for the division of labor to exist in an extensive temporal succession, in which groups of workers produce tools or materials taken up by other succeeding groups over a long period of time, it is absolutely vital that there be capital funds, so that each group can be paid within a reasonable time after completing its work. The existence of capital funds introduces a necessary division of payments, so to speak, that corresponds to the temporal division of labor. In the absence of capital funds, there is only one source of payment, the ultimate final consumers, whose outlays lie months, years, generations, even centuries in the future. With the existence of capital funds, there is immediate payment, however far in the future the expenditures of the ultimate final consumers may lie. Only because of the existence of capital funds can the division of labor exist in an extensive temporal succession. And the greater is the accumulation of capital funds relative to consumer spending, the greater is the employment of labor serving the achievement of temporally remoter ends. In other words, the more does labor in the present serve consumption in the future, and the more is consumption in the present served by labor performed in the past. As we will see tomorrow, the effect of labor being able to be employed for temporarily more remote ends is to accelerate the rise in its productivity, because longer chains of cause and effect can be brought to bear in production. Thus, saving and capital accumulation lay the groundworks for the division of labor in initially raising the productivity of agricultural labor. Thus, saving and capital accumulation lay the groundwork for the division of labor in initially raising the productivity of agricultural labor so that people can be spared for industry, and in establishing a division of payments. As we will see tomorrow, the further they are carried relative to consumption, the more rapid the rate of economic progress. Now let us turn to the necessity of exchange and money in a division of labor society. As I have stated, in a division of labor society, each person produces or helps to produce just one, or at most a very few things, and is dependent for his consumption on the goods and services produced by a host of others. Some mechanism must exist whereby the products of each can be channeled to others and the products of others channeled to each. Exchange is that mechanism. A division of labor society requires exchange on a massive scale as a constant major feature of economic life. In a division of labor society, all or practically all of everyone's production must leave him through the process of exchange, and all or practically all of everyone's consumption must come to him through the process of exchange. But a special kind of exchange is required to make this possible. The direct barter exchange of goods for goods is not sufficient. In order for an exchange to take place under such conditions, a so-called double coincidence of wants must exist. That is, each of the two parties to the exchange must possess what the other desires and desire what the other possesses. This condition, very often, indeed, usually, cannot be realized. For example, a producer of ball bearings, steel girders, or sulfuric acid desires food possessed by grocers or farmers. Yet few or no grocers or farmers desire ball bearings, steel girders, or sulfuric acid. If exchange were confined to direct barter, producers of goods like ball bearings, etc., could not live by producing them. and so would not produce them. Indeed, hardly anyone could live by producing the goods or services he now produces. For consider how few people today produce things that are consumed to any significant extent by those who supply them. For example, how many of you are producing things consumed by your grocer or landlord? And even where people might be engaged in producing things that would be desired by their suppliers, it would still be impossible to effect many valuable exchanges. For example, the producers of television sets or the builders of houses desire bread and shoes, and the producers of bread and shoes desire television sets and houses. Putting aside such problems as the houses probably being in the wrong location for the bread and shoe producers, how could the producers of bread and shoes make change for a television set or a house? Also, how could the producers of the television sets or houses pay their employees? With a fraction of a television set per hour? With a piece of a house per week? An economic system operating under the constraints of direct barter exchange would obviously offer very limited opportunities for division of labor and would thus be very primitive. To live in such an economic system, one would either have to be a farmer or produce the kinds of things that could readily be exchanged with farmers, such as blacksmithing services. What is required for the existence of a division of labor society is the existence of money and monetary exchange. Money is a good readily acceptable in exchange by everyone, and is sought for the purpose of being re-exchanged. And one of the properties of money that helps to make it universally acceptable is its divisibility into small units. With money, those for whom one produces and those by whom one is supplied can be, and almost always are, different and distinct parties. One produces for anyone who has money to offer, and then uses the money to buy from anyone who has the goods one wants. With the existence of money, the producers of ball bearings, steel girders, and so on sell them for money to whomever wants them and has money to offer for them, and then turn around and spend the money in buying food or whatever else they may wish from whomever they desire. You and I work in our specializations, are paid money, and buy from all manner of people who do not at all consume the goods or services we ourselves produce. With money, the producers of television sets and the builders of houses can easily obtain items as small as a single loaf of bread or pair of shoes because they sell their products for sums of money that in turn are divisible into parts as small as the price of a loaf of bread or a pair of shoes. The employees of these producers are likewise easily paid. In these ways, money radically enlarges the opportunities for specialization. It makes specialization possible not merely in a comparative handful of cases, but universally. Consistent with our earlier discussion of the price system, the use of money also solves another problem that would otherwise be insoluble and prevent the existence of a division of labor society. Namely, it makes it possible to perform economic calculations and thus economic comparisons. Without the use of money, a productive process would show only a variety of physical means of production at the beginning and some physical product at the end. For example, it would show at the beginning quantities of building materials, equipment, and goods exchanged for labor services, and at the end, a finished building. It would be impossible to determine if the product represented a gain or a loss of wealth, because one would be comparing quantities of different kinds, with no common denominator in terms of which to add them or subtract them. But with the use of money, producers are able to compare the market value of their outputs with the market value of their inputs. They can also compare the costs of using different methods of production and the profitability of the different branches of industry. All of this is vital if production in the various branches of the division of labor system is to be properly coordinated and not collapse into chaos. Thus, the existence of money is vital to the existence of a division of labor society by radically widening the possibilities for exchange and by making possible economic calculations and economic comparisons. Before turning to the role of competition in a division of labor society, I would like to digress for a few moments on the origins of money. Money evolved out of barter. What made it evolve was the actions of individuals serving their rational self-interests. Some of our more intelligent ancestors, who encountered the problem of a lack of a double coincidence of wants, invented the practice of indirect exchange, which others soon copied. What this means is that they exchanged the goods they possessed for other goods that they themselves did not desire, but which those whose goods they sought did desire. For example, the owner of a raft, say, who desired a team of horses owned by someone who did not desire a raft, would exchange the raft for goods that the owner of the horses did desire, or which people possessing such goods desired. Perhaps he would exchange his raft for an ox that the owner of the horses desired. Perhaps he first had to exchange it for a quantity of iron or wheat, or whatever, before he could obtain the ox desired by the owner of the horses. In any case, what is crucial is that people began to exchange their goods for other goods, which they sought neither as articles of personal consumption, nor as means of further production, but as means of effecting further exchanges. In this way, media of exchange began to develop. In this process, certain goods naturally came to be more widely preferred as media of exchange than others. Other things being equal, the larger the number of users of a good as an ordinary commodity, and the more frequent their use of it, the more would it be preferred as a medium of exchange. For once in possession of such a good, the likelihood of finding someone possessing what one desired and who was willing to accept this good would be substantially greater than the likelihood of finding someone who possessed what one desired and who was willing to take either one's original good or any other good. It is on this principle that in societies of nomads, cattle naturally emerged as a kind of money. Practically all nomads always want more cattle as the means of supporting larger families and larger numbers of servants. As a result, anyone who wants something from nomads is more likely to be able to obtain it if he can offer them cattle. It was on the same principle that in the years immediately following World War II, cigarettes emerged as a kind of money in the black markets of various European countries. The large number of people seeking cigarettes to smoke made cigarettes a logical good for everyone, even non-smokers, to seek in exchange for their goods. Because once in possession of cigarettes, the odds of finding someone in possession of the goods one wanted were greatly increased. The example of cigarettes contains a further principle, and that is, the process of certain goods being selected as media of exchange in preference to others tends to be self-reinforcing and cumulative. For example, as soon as non-smokers become willing to accept cigarettes because of the large number of smokers to trade with, the effect is to increase the ability of cigarettes to serve as a medium of exchange, because now they are even more widely acceptable than before. In this way, the acceptability of the most preferred media of exchange tends to go on increasing until after they, or it, are universally acceptable, that is, have developed into money. In different periods of history, in different places, a variety of goods have served as commonly used media of exchange, or virtual monies. Among them, cattle, sheep, hides, furs, cocoa, tobacco, cigarettes, salt, seashells, beads, iron, copper, tin, and, of course, gold and silver. Everywhere, however, the rise of civilization appears to have been accompanied by the triumph of gold and silver over all other contenders for the office of money. This is no accident. The rise of civilization entails fixed settlements, trade over great distances, and economic activity spanning long periods of time. Such developments make the use of animals, or animal or vegetable products, as money, unsuitable. Such things are all perishable and relatively expensive for dwellers in fixed settlements to transport or store. In comparison with them, practically any of the metals is superior because of its imperishability and lower costs of storage. The precious metals have the further decisive advantage of representing a comparatively high value in a small bulk. Thus, it is less costly to transport and to store a given amount of exchange value in the form of gold or silver than in the form of iron, copper, or tin. Needless to say, all of the metals are also divisible and recombinable, something that is totally impossible in the case of animals, seashells, beads, and the like. The precious metals came to be money because they are the most suitable commodities for most people to save. Their desirability as a means of saving, as a so-called store of value, made them acceptable to large numbers of people as a means of payment, the people who wanted to save them. The willingness of these people to accept them in exchange led others, who did not wish to hold them as a store of value, also to accept them in exchange, in the knowledge that they could re-exchange them with those who did. This, of course, increased the acceptability of the precious metals as media of exchange, and on that basis made them still more acceptable as media of exchange. The desire to hold precious metals as a store of value and their growing use as media of exchange represented an additional demand for them over and above the demand for them as ordinary commodities. This additional demand could be met only with increasing difficulty because of the comparative rarity of these metals in nature. The result was a rise in the value of the precious metals, which further reinforced their desirability as a store of value and medium of exchange. The culmination of these processes was the establishment of gold and silver as money throughout the civilized world. Coinage, the certification of the fineness and weight of specific pieces of the precious metals, followed their widespread use as a store of value and medium of exchange. Many centuries later, paper money came into use as transferable claims to quantities of gold and silver payable on demand. Over the course of more than two centuries, as the result of steadily increasing government intervention in their favor, paper banknotes and checks gradually displaced gold and silver in active circulation, to the point where today several generations of people have grown up with the experience of government paper as a universally acceptable good. Today, everyone is willing to accept paper money in payment for his goods, because he has had the constantly repeated experience and thus has the expectation that everyone else is willing to accept it from him. But the divorce of money from the precious metals that governments have achieved is producing consequences that are setting the stage for an eventual remonetization of the precious metals, along the very same lines that led to their becoming money in the first place. Because money has been divorced from the precious metals, there are no longer any limits to its creation, and thus no longer any guarantees of its value. All over the world, inflation, the unchecked creation of paper money, is a major problem. Inflation drives up prices, and thus wipes out the buying power of bonds, savings deposits, life insurance policies, and pensions. It undermines the gains from business activity and stock ownership by artificially increasing profits calculated in money, which profits are actually required merely to meet the higher costs of replacing assets, but which are taxed and consumed as though they were genuine gains. The consequence is that people have begun turning away from all these traditional forms of investment in favor of investments that are superior as inflation hedges, that is, investments whose price will rise at least in pace with the rise in prices generally, and on which taxes can be minimized or altogether avoided. The best possible inflation hedges for most people are gold and silver, because of their minimal storage costs and ease of concealment. Thus, as inflation proceeds, more and more people wish to hold gold and silver as a store of value. And of course, everyone who wishes to add to his gold or silver holdings is potentially willing to accept them to that extent in payment for his goods or services. If not thwarted by governments, it is likely that the time will come when buyers who possess gold or silver will frequently encounter sellers who desire to acquire gold or silver. At that point, gold and silver will reemerge as media of exchange. This development would be greatly accelerated by the legal enforceability of contracts made in terms of precious metals. If significant debts become payable in gold or silver, those who owed these debts would be willing sellers for gold or silver in order to obtain the means of paying them. Once the precious metals emerged in open competition with paper money as a medium of exchange, it would not be difficult to forecast which would be the winner. The precious metals retain or increase their buying power, while paper money steadily loses its buying power. The result would be a growing preference of people for the precious metals over paper money. It is the precious metals that they would want to be paid in. This would further increase the demand for and value of the precious metals, and correspondingly reduce the demand for and value of paper money. Unless the paper money were once again made redeemable in the precious metals, it would lose all of its acceptability and value as people turn to the superior monies constituted by gold and silver. So much for the evolution of money. Now let me turn to the dependence of a division of labor society on the institution of economic competition and the freedom of competition. As I explained yesterday, a major source of the gains from the division of labor is that the production of everything is carried on by those who are able to do it best. Economic competition is the process of establishing who is able to produce things best. Actually, the significance of economic competition for the division of labor is even wider than this statement may suggest. For it is the process that establishes not only which individuals are best suited in the eyes of the market for all the various occupations, from wealthy businessman on down to janitor, but also which products are best suited for any given market, and which technological methods are best suited for the production of any given product. This last embraces, for example, such choices as machine versus handicraft production, larger scale production versus smaller scale production, using copper versus using aluminum, or coal versus oil, producing in one geographical location or in another, and so forth. Thus, economic competition is the process of determining the organization of a division of labor society with respect to the choice of products for markets, technological methods for production, and persons for occupations. Economic competition is necessary because the most efficient form of organization of a division of labor society is not automatically known. Also, it is subject to constant change, as new products and methods of production are discovered, or old ones forgotten, as individuals' personal knowledge and preferences change, as capital is accumulated or decumulated, as the size and composition of the population changes, as new mineral deposits are found or old ones exhausted, and as soil and climate conditions change. In a free market, those who have differing opinions about which product is best suited for given customers, which method is most appropriate for producing a given product, or who is best qualified for a given job, come forward and submit their goods, their investments, and their talents to the judgment of the markets in which they seek to operate, and succeed or fail according to the judgment of those markets. The judgment of a market, of course, is never final, in that individuals are always free to make further appeals to it, and again succeed in swaying it to their side when they have something better to offer. Consistent with our earlier discussion of the price system, economic competition, or more correctly, the freedom of such competition, is necessary to a division of labor society in a further respect as well, namely to prevent it from being put at the mercy of the whims of particular categories of producers. By its very nature, a division of labor society vitally depends on the work done by various small minorities of people constituting particular categories of producers. In many cases, such minorities have been able to coerce the rest of the society into meeting their arbitrary demands on pain of a breakdown of the economic system. One has only to think of the consequences of prolonged strikes in such fields as transportation, steel making, coal mining, electric power production, or even garbage collection, and the terms on which such strikes are almost always settled. The existence of these cases is the result of violations of the freedom of competition by labor unions. In practically every country, the unions have succeeded in having laws enacted that greatly restrict the employment of workers taking the place of strikers. In addition, where such replacement workers are legally able to work, The unions are able to practice policies of violence and intimidation, against which there is little or no legal recourse. One has only to recall news pictures of mobs of burly workers blocking factory gates during a strike, and the reports of slashed tires, shootings, and bombings that so frequently accompany strikes. Under current law in the United States, striking workers virtually own their jobs, which must be held open for them even though they refuse to work. Also, no legal protection can be obtained against so-called mass picketing, and the police and district attorneys rarely enforce the laws against assault and battery and property damage when it comes to union violence. In these ways, the unions and the government succeed in prohibiting freedom of competition in the labor market, and thus in compelling the entire rest of society to give in to whatever arbitrary demands that the unions in various critical branches of production may choose to make. While this is a subject that requires a much fuller discussion, nevertheless, I'd like to say now that the freedom of competition would be a sufficient guarantee against arbitrary demands by business firms as well as wage earners, even in cases in which the result of competition might be the establishment of just one company in a particular branch of production, such as one electric power or gas company in a given town. The freedom of competition would permit the entry of a new electric or gas company if the existing one's rates became excessive, and this fact would operate as a powerful check on the rates charged by the existing company. Also, in cases such as these, it is almost certain that different suppliers would compete with one another in terms of offering the customers in a given area long-term contractual guarantees concerning rates and services, so that when a company did succeed in becoming the sole supplier, it would operate under the terms of such a contract and not be able to impose high rates even temporarily. Under such an arrangement, an excessive rate or price would not mean one that was arbitrarily increased by a supplier, but one that failed to reflect improvements in efficiency made by other potential suppliers. A division of labor society also depends on the institution of economic inequality, insofar as economic inequality results from the process of economic competition, or, more broadly, from individuals freely engaging in production and exchange, whether they are in competition with one another or not. Economic inequality, of course, can also be the product of government coercion, as occurs under feudalism and socialism, which is why I did not describe it as an institution to which private property is essential. A division of labor society depends on economic inequality in the sense that it depends on individuals being free and motivated to produce. Economic inequality results from the fact that individuals have unequal talents and unequal degrees of ambition. The abolition of economic inequality would mean the abolition of all connection between an individual's efforts and his income. It would be tantamount to the abolition of causality in the receipt of income. To understand why this would be the result, imagine that a group of just 10 people were formed whose members agreed to share equally all the income earned by any one of them. Now imagine that a member of this group found a way to increase the income he earns by some given amount. Since he has to turn it over to the group and share it equally with the other 9 members of the group, the personal benefit which he would obtain would be only 1/10 of that amount. If the group consisted of 1,000 people, then any individual who increased or decreased the income he earned by any given amount would personally experience a gain or loss of only 1/1,000th of that amount. He would personally gain or lose only $1 for every $1,000 by which he increased or decreased the income of the group. If, as the egalitarians desire, the group consisted of the whole population of the United States or of the world, then for any given amount by which an individual increased or decreased the income of the group, he would increase or decrease the income available to him personally by only 1/220,000,000th, or 1/4,000,000,000th of that amount. With an important exception, or seeming exception, that I will discuss in a moment, it is obvious that once the size of the egalitarian group becomes substantial, probably anything much in excess of 10, no significant connection can exist between what an individual produces and what he receives. And, what is also very significant, no significant connection can exist between what an individual produces and what any other particular individual receives. In a group as small as 10, say, especially if it consists of close friends and relatives, an individual might rationally consider the effect of his actions on the income available to the other members of the group, and give it substantial weight in deciding how much to produce. But in any large group, the individual loses the power significantly to affect the income available to any other individual, as well as losing the power significantly to affect the income available to himself. In a group of 1,000, 1,000,000, or 1,000,000,000, nothing the average individual does can significantly affect the income received by his wife and children, or parents and friends. Even their combined share is an insignificant part of the group's total income. As I say, nothing he does can have any significant effect on the income of the group as a whole, for he is only one among many, and his production a small part of the total production. In collectivizing his product and spreading it over a large group, egalitarianism destroys the ability of the great majority of individuals to achieve results that are of significance to anyone. The average individual is capable of accomplishing results that are large in relation to himself, and large in relation to his immediate family. But very few individuals are capable of accomplishing results that are large in relation to significantly greater numbers of people. It is as though egalitarianism, seeing that individuals had legs easily strong enough to support their own weight, demanded that each individual's legs had to support the weight of the whole human race as the requirement for his being permitted to walk. To make it the job of the individual to improve his own life and well-being only insofar as he improves the life and well-being of everyone else in the country or the world is a demand that is no less absurd. If implemented, it would simply give everyone the incentive to do as little as possible. In the same way that doubling one's production, if that were possible, would increase one's own income by only 1/220,000,000th if egalitarianism were on a national scale, or 1/4,000,000,000th if it were on a world scale, and thus would not be undertaken, so getting away with not producing anything at all would reduce one's own income only by that amount. Increasing one's production would not be a perceptible benefit to anyone, and decreasing it would not be a perceptible loss to anyone. As a result, everyone would try to do nothing. At the same time, it should be realized that while encouraging them to do nothing, egalitarianism leads people to demand everything. It is not only tantamount to the abolition of causality in the earning of income, but of cost in the spending of income. To make something free to the individual and chargeable to the group as a whole is to make the consumption of the individual virtually costless, both to himself and to every other individual. Take the case of socialized medicine, for example. If visits to doctors are made free to the individual and chargeable to the taxpayers collectively, then each individual perceives the benefit of his going to a doctor, while he and every other taxpayer experiences a personal cost equal to the cost of the visit divided by the number of millions of taxpayers. In such circumstances, every individual is encouraged to take advantage of the situation and, as a result, the overall cost to everyone actually ends up greatly increasing. What happens is this. A doctor's visit that might cost an individual $50, say, is passed on to, say, 50 million taxpayers, each of whom it costs 1/50,000,000th of $50. But now, perhaps, 200 million people each want to make 5 times as many doctor's visits, and so the total cost to everyone ends up being vastly greater than it would otherwise have been. And people don't actually succeed in obtaining additional medical service either. In part, the effect is simply to make doctors' fees and other medical costs rise, and in part to create shortages of doctors' time, as manifested in crowded waiting rooms and reduced time with each patient. It should be realized that equality of income implies forced labor, because, as shown, it eliminates the earning of income as a positive incentive to work. If people are to work without income as the incentive, the only remaining means of getting them to work is force. It is true that there are other positive incentives for working besides income, such as the enjoyment of the work itself. But for the great majority of jobs, this factor exists in a form that is closely related to the earning of income, and is largely felt only after the work is completed and the satisfaction of supporting oneself can be experienced. For example, no one digs ditches, hauls garbage, mines coal, works on an assembly line or in an office, or is even president of a bank for the sheer love of his work, apart from all connection with the income it brings him. And even in the cases in which the work all by itself may really be a source of pleasure, for example, in the arts and sciences, this would not be sufficient to induce the amount of work that is presently done, and that only the earning of income elicits. For example, I personally very much enjoy lecturing on economics, and would want to continue teaching even if I were a millionaire and didn't need the income from it. But instead of teaching two or three classes every term, I'd probably want to teach only one class every other term. I mentioned an exception to the inability of individuals to achieve perceptible results in relation to large groups. The exception pertains to individuals of unusually great ability. A great scientist, inventor, or businessman is capable of increasing production so greatly that the whole world can experience a perceptible benefit. Yet this exception certainly does not represent a case in which economic equality would be practicable. On the contrary, precisely it presupposes the possibility of very great economic inequality. First of all, no scientist, inventor, or businessman should be imagined to be motivated to devote his life to raising the standard of living of the world by 1, 2, 5, or X percent in order that he may, as part of the process, raise his own standard of living by 1, 2, 5, or X percent. That would be an absurdly bad bargain, to work so hard and achieve so much for the rest of the world and so little for oneself. The main value that a scientist achieves is the intellectual satisfaction of making his discoveries. In his case, this may stand in the place of any very great material reward. But inventors generally require the prospect of substantial material rewards, or they will not devote the time and effort or go to the expense that is necessary to make an invention. And businessmen, who are the ones who actually implement the work of scientists and inventors, who search out and perfect the inventions, and who often set the scientists and inventors to work in the first place, or are scientists and inventors themselves, their work takes place for no other reason than as the means of accumulating a personal fortune, and is possible for the most part only to the extent that they have already accumulated one. Thus, the whole foundation of individuals of exceptional ability being able to act on a scale that raises the standard of living of everyone is precisely the existence of enormous economic inequality. Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie could raise the standard of living of the world only in the course of accumulating their fortunes, and only on the basis of the fortunes they had already accumulated. Thus, the demand for economic equality turns out to be opposed to causality in a double respect, in respect both of the incentives to production and of the means of production. It would deprive the average person of the incentive to produce by depriving his productive effort of virtually all effect on his own or anyone else's standard of living. It would deprive the very able person of the incentive to produce by making the effect of his productive effort on his standard of living too small, and by depriving him of the material means of achieving very great productive effects in the first place. I would like everyone to understand that at a fundamental level, the criticism of economic equality I am making is not directed against economic equality per se. Fundamentally, it is a criticism merely of any sort of requirement that people be economically equal. Nor is the defense I offer for economic inequality a defense of economic inequality per se. It is a defense merely of the freedom and the desire of people to prosper. I am not advocating that anyone be prevented from being economically equal, or that anyone be made economically better off or worse off than anyone else. I am advocating only that everyone be free to follow the desire to prosper and to be able to keep as his own whatever he achieves. From this, economic inequality inexorably emerges, simply because not everyone is equally intelligent, talented, or ambitious, or saves as great a proportion of his income. It emerges as the consequence of different individuals enacting different degrees of causation. I am opposed to economic equality because it is incompatible with individuals enacting causation, because it deprives them of the effects they enact and of the further means of enacting causation. It should also be mentioned that economic inequality plays a vital role specifically in connection with the institutions of saving and capital accumulation and economic competition. The highest incomes in a capitalist society are those earned by successful businessmen. Insofar as such incomes represent the earning of high rates of profit on capital invested, the greater part of them tends to be saved and invested as the means of accumulating a fortune. Fortunes are built by earning a high rate of profit on a rapidly growing capital, a capital which grows rapidly because most of the high rate of profit is constantly reinvested. High incomes are also frequently of the kind that they must be regarded as temporary or exceptional by their recipients. For example, the incomes of authors of best-selling books and of successful professional athletes and movie stars. If such people want to enjoy the benefit of their currently high incomes over the course of their whole lives, they must save a very substantial portion of them. It is for these reasons, I believe, that a close, observable relationship exists between relatively high incomes and high rates of saving out of income. It follows from these connections that attempts to restrict economic inequality must substantially reduce saving and capital accumulation. The role played by economic inequality in connection with economic competition is that it profoundly influences the areas in which people choose to compete. For example, the fact that Mr. A, the engineer, earns substantially more than Mr. B, the mechanic, ensures that Mr. A will not compete against Mr. B for the job of mechanic, even though he might make a much better mechanic. The inequality of income leads people to compete only in the areas of those of their talents that pay the most, and to abstain from competing in the areas of those of their talents that pay less. It operates when necessary to enable the less able actually to outcompete the more able, and thus it guarantees them a place in the economic system. I will elaborate on these points when we come to the discussion of the law of comparative advantage in a further discussion of economic competition. Finally, I come again to the dependence of a division of labor society on the profit motive and the price system. The profit motive makes everyone be concerned with the revenue or income he earns and the costs or expenses he incurs. As I have shown, precisely this is what harmonizes and integrates the economic plans and the economic activities of all the separate businesses and individuals who make up a division of labor society. The principles describing just how this occurs are the subject matter of price theory. I explain them in the first two chapters of The Government Against the Economy. As a brief summary of those chapters, let me say that the profit motive and the price system provide powerful incentives for the steady expansion and improvement of production, and at the same time operate to keep the relative production of all the various industries and occupations in proper balance. They make production accord with the will of the ultimate buyers, the consumers, and assure that the production of each individual good takes place in a way that is maximally conducive to production in the rest of the economic system. They assure the most rational and efficient allocation of every type of labor and material among its possible alternative uses, and make the economic system respond to changes in economic conditions in the most rational and efficient manner. Finally, they balance the demand and supply of each product and assure the most rational and efficient distribution of it over space and time, among all the markets that compete for it, and its delivery into the hands of those individuals who, within the limits of their wealth and income, need or desire it the most. The profit motive and the price system are what prevent any sort of anarchy of production, and instead create economic order and harmony out of the activities of tens and hundreds of millions of people, each working on his own account, for his own ends. For they coordinate all the different branches of the division of labor and the activities of all the different individuals who comprise it. They are what enables capitalism to be an economic system that is rationally and cohesively planned by each and every individual who participates in it. As I say, for details and for proof, see the first two chapters of my book. By way of summary, what I have shown this morning is the dependence of a division of labor society on the institutions of capitalism, namely private property, saving and capital accumulation, exchange and money, economic competition and economic inequality, and the profit motive and the price system. All of these, in turn, with the exception of economic inequality, I first showed to depend on the institution of private property, which itself is the product of individual freedom and rational self-interest, the two most fundamental and pervasive of all the institutions of capitalism. In my remaining lectures, I will explain the reflux influence of the division of labor itself on the institutions of private property, economic inequality, and economic competition, and show how it leads these institutions to promote a harmony of the rational self-interests of all men. Thank you.